Welcome to the Public Domain Podcast. This week's podcast is number 9. It'll be part 3 of The Master of the World by Jules Verne, which will include chapters 5, Along the Shores of New England, and 6, The First Letter. If you've missed the other parts of the novel, you can download them at publicdomainpodcast.blogspot.com and look for podcast numbers 6 and 7, and you'll be caught up to the novel. All right, let's get on with this week's reading.
Chapter 5, Along the Shores of New England.
At the time when the newspapers were filled with these reports, I was again in Washington. On my return, I had presented myself at my chief's office, but had been unable to see him. Family affairs had suddenly called him away, to be absent some weeks. Mr. Ward, however, undoubtedly knew of the failure of my mission. The newspapers, especially those of North Carolina, had given full details of our ascent to the Great Eyrie. Naturally, I was much annoyed by this delay, which further fretted my restless curiosity. I could turn to new other plans for the future. Could I give up the hope of learning the secret of the Great Eyrie? No. I would return to the attack 12 times if necessary, and despite every failure. Surely, the winning of access within those walls was not a task beyond human power. A scaffolding might be raised to the summit of the cliff, or a tunnel might be pierced through its depth. Our engineers met problems more difficult every day. But in this case, it was necessary to consider the expense, which might easily grow out of proportion to the advantages to be gained. A tunnel would cost many $1,000s, and what good would it accomplish, beyond satisfying the public curiosity and my own? My personal resources were wholly insufficient for the achievement. Mr. Ward, who held the government's funds, was away. I even thought of trying to interest some millionaire. Oh, if I could but have promised one of them some gold or silver mines within the mountain! But such a hypothesis was not admissible. The chain of the Appalachians is not situated in a gold-bearing region like that of the Pacific Mountains, the Transvaal, or Australia. It was not until the 15th of June that Mr. Ward returned to duty. Despite my lack of success, he received me warmly. "Here is our poor Strock," cried he at my entrance. "Our poor Strock who has failed." "No more, Mr. Ward, than if you had charged me to investigate the surface of the moon," answered I. "We found ourselves face to face with purely natural obstacles, insurmountable with the forces then in our command." "I do not doubt that, Strock. I do not doubt that in the least. Nevertheless, the fact remains that you have discovered nothing of what is going on within the Great Eyrie."
"Nothing, Mr. Ward."
"You saw no sign of fire?"
"None."
"And you heard no suspicious noises whatever?"
"None."
"Then it is still uncertain if there is really a volcano there?"
"Still uncertain, Mr. Ward. But if it is there, we have good reason to believe that it has sunk into a profound sleep."
"Still," returned Mr. Ward, "there is nothing to show that it will not wake up again any day, Strock. It is not enough that a volcano should sleep. It must be absolutely extinguished, unless, indeed, all these threatening rumors have been born solely in the Carolinian imagination."
"That is not possible, sir," I said. "Both Mr. Smith, the mayor of Morganton, and his friend, the mayor of Pleasant Garden, are reliable men, and they speak from their own knowledge in this matter. Flames have certainly risen above the Great Eyrie. Strange noises have issued from it. There can be no doubt whatever the reality of these phenomena."
"Granted," declared Mr. Ward, "I admit that the evidence is unassailable. So the deduction to be drawn is that the Great Eyrie has not yet given up its secret."
"If we are determined to know it, Mr. Ward, the solution is only a solution of expense. Pickaxes and dynamite would soon conquer those walls."
"No doubt," responded the chief, "but such an undertaking hardly seems justified since the mountain is now quiet. We will wait a while, and perhaps nature herself will disclose her mystery."
"Mr. Ward, believe me that I regret deeply that I have been unable to solve the problem you entrusted to me," I said.
"Nonsense. Do not upset yourself, Strock. Take your defeat philosophically. We cannot always be successful, even in the police. How many criminals escape us? I believe we should never capture one of them if they were a little more intelligent and less imprudent, and if they did not compromise themselves so stupidly. Nothing, it seems to me, would be easier than to plan a crime, a theft, or an assassination, and to execute it without raising any suspicions or leaving any traces to be followed. You understand, Strock. I do not want to give our criminals lessons. I much prefer to have them remain as they are. Nevertheless, there are many whom the police will never be able to track down."
On this matter I shared absolutely the opinion of my chief. It is among rascals that one finds the most fools. For this very reason I had been much surprised that none of the authorities had been able to throw any light upon the recent performances of the demon automobile, and when Mr. Ward brought up the subject, I did not conceal from him my astonishment. He pointed out that the vehicle was practically unpursuable, that in its earlier appearances it had apparently vanished from all roads even before a telephone message could be sent ahead. Active and numerous police agents had been spread throughout the country, but no one of them had encountered the delinquent. He did not move continuously from place to place, even at his amazing speed, but seemed to appear only for a moment and then to vanish into thin air.
True, he had at length remained visible along the entire route from Prairie du Chien to Milwaukee, and he had covered in less than an hour and a half this track of 200 miles. But since then, there had been no news whatever of the machine. Arrived at the end of the route, driven onward by its own impetus, unable to stop, had it indeed been engulfed within the waters of Lake Michigan. Must we conclude that the machine and its driver had both perished, that there was no longer any danger to be feared from either? The great majority of the public refused to accept this conclusion. They fully expected the machine to reappear. Mr. Ward frankly admitted that the whole matter seemed to him most extraordinary, and I shared his view. Assuredly, if this infernal chauffeur did not return, his apparition would have to be placed among those superhuman mysteries which it is not given to man to understand. We had fully discussed this affair, the chief and I thought that our interview was at an end, when, after pacing the room for a few moments, he said abruptly, "Yes, what happened here at Milwaukee was very strange. But here is something no less so." With this he handed me a report, which he had received from Boston, on a subject of which the evening papers had just begun to apprise their readers. While I read it, Mr. Ward was summoned from the room. I seated myself by the window and studied with extreme attention the matter of the report. For some days the waters along the coast of Maine, Connecticut, and Massachusetts had been the scene of an appearance which no one could exactly describe. A moving body would appear amid the waters, some 2 or 3 miles offshore, and go through rapid evolutions. It would flash for a while back and forth among the waves, and then dart out of sight. The body moved with such lightning speed that the best telescopes could hardly follow it. Its length did not seem to exceed 30 feet. Its cigar-shaped form and greenish color made it difficult to distinguish against the background of the ocean. It had been most frequently observed along the coast between Cape Cod and Nova Scotia. From Providence, from Boston, from Portsmouth, and from Portland, motor boats and steam launches had repeatedly attempted to approach this moving body and even to give it chase. They could not get anywhere near it. Pursuit seemed useless. It darted like an arrow beyond the range of view. Naturally, widely different opinions were held as to the nature of this object, but no hypothesis rested on any secure basis. Seamen were as much at a loss as others. At first, sailors thought it must be some great fish, like a whale. But it is well known that all these animals come to the surface with a certain regularity to breathe, and spat up columns of mingled air and water. Now, this strange animal, if it was an animal, had never blown, as the whalers say, nor had it ever made any noises of breathing. Yet, if it were not one of these huge marine mammals, how was this unknown monster to be classed? Did it belong among the legendary dwellers in the deep, the krakens, the octopuses, the leviathans, the famous sea serpents? At any rate, since this monster, whatever it was, had appeared along the New England shores, the little fishing smacks and pleasure boats dared not venture forth. Wherever it appeared, the boats fled to the nearest harbor, as was but prudent. If the animal was of a ferocious character, none cared to await its attack. As to the large ships and coast steamers, they had nothing to fear from any monster, whale or otherwise. Several of them had seen this creature at a distance of some miles, but when they attempted to approach, it fled rapidly away. One day, even, a fast United States gunboat went out from Boston, if not to pursue the monster, at least to send after it a few cannon shot. Almost instantly the animal disappeared, and the attempt was vain. As yet, however, the monster had shown no intention of attacking either boats or people. At this moment Mr. Ward returned, and I interrupted my reading to say, "There seems as yet no reason to complain of this sea serpent. It flees before big ships. It does not pursue little ones. Feeling and intelligence are not very strong in fishes. Yet their emotions exist, Strock. And, if strongly aroused..." "But, Mr. Ward, the beast seems not at all dangerous. One of two things will happen.
Either it will presently quit these coasts, or finally it will be captured, and we shall be able to study it at our leisure, here in the Museum of Washington. "And if it is not a marine animal?" asked Mr. Ward. "What else can it be?" I protested in surprise. "Finish your reading," said Mr. Ward. I did so, and found that in the second part of the report my chief had underlined some passages in red pencil. For some time no one had doubted that this was an animal, and that, if it were vigorously pursued, it would at last be driven from our shores. But a change of opinion had come about. People began to ask if, instead of a fish, this were not some new and remarkable kind of boat. Certainly in that case its engine must be one of amazing power. Perhaps the inventor, before selling the secret of his invention, sought to attract public attention and to astound the maritime world. Such surety in the movements of this boat, grace in its every evolution, such ease in defying pursuit by its arrow-like speed, surely these were enough to arouse worldwide curiosity. At that time great progress had been made in the manufacture of marine engines. Huge transatlantic steamers completed the ocean passage in 5 days, and the engineers had not yet spoken their last word. Neither were the navies of the world behind. The cruisers, the torpedo boats, the torpedo destroyers, could match the swiftest steamers of the Atlantic and Pacific, or of the Indian trade. If, however, this were a boat of some new design, there had as yet been no opportunity to observe its form. As to the engines which drove it, they must be of a power far beyond the fastest known. By what force they worked was equally a problem. Since the boat had no sails, it was not driven by the wind, and since it had no smokestack, it was not driven by steam. At this point in the report, I again paused in my reading and considered the comment I wished to make. "What are you puzzling over, Strock?" demanded my chief. "It is this, Mr. Ward. The motive power of this so-called boat must be as tremendous and as unknown as that of the remarkable automobile which so amazed us all." "So that is your idea, is it, Strock?" "Yes, Mr. Ward." There was but one conclusion to be drawn. If the mysterious chauffeur had disappeared, if he had perished with his machine in Lake Michigan, it was equally important now to win the secret of this no less mysterious navigator, and it must be won before he in his turn plunged into the abyss of the ocean. Was it not the interest of the inventor to disclose his invention? Would not the American government or any other give him any price he chose to ask? Yet, unfortunately, since the inventor of the terrestrial apparition had persisted in preserving his incognito, was it not to be feared that the inventor of the marine apparition would equally preserve his? Even if the first machine still existed, it was no longer heard from, and would not the second, in the same way, after having disclosed its powers, disappear in its turn without a single trace? What gave weight to this probability was that since the arrival of this report at Washington 24 hours before, the presence of the extraordinary boat hadn't been announced from anywhere along the shore. Neither had it been seen on any other coast. Though, of course, the assertion that it would not reappear at all would have been hazardous, to say the least. I noted another interesting and possibly important point. It was a singular coincidence which indeed Mr. Ward suggested to me, at the same moment that I was considering it. This was that only after the disappearance of the wonderful automobile had the no less wonderful boat come into view. Moreover, their engines both possessed a most dangerous power of locomotion. If both should go rushing at the same time over the face of the world, the same danger would threaten mankind everywhere, in boats, in vehicles, and on foot. Therefore, it was absolutely necessary that the police should in some manner interfere to protect the public ways of travel. That is what Mr. Ward pointed out to me. And our duty was obvious. But how could we accomplish this task? We discussed the matter for some time, and I was just about to leave when Mr. Ward made one last suggestion. "Have you not observed, Strock," said he, "that there is a sort of fantastic resemblance between the general appearance of this boat and this automobile?" "There is something of the sort, Mr. Ward." "Well, is it not possible that the two are one?" Chapter 6. The First Letter. After leaving Mr. Ward, I returned to my home in Long Street. There I had plenty of time to consider the strange case uninterrupted by either wife or children. My household consisted solely of an ancient servant, who, having been formerly in the service of my mother, had now continued for 15 years in mine. 2 months before I had obtained a leave of absence. It had still 2 weeks to run, unless, indeed, some unforeseen circumstance interrupted it,
some mission which could not be delayed. This leave, as I have shown, had already been interrupted for 4 days by my exploration of the Great Eyrie. And now was it not my duty to abandon my vacation and endeavor to throw light upon the remarkable events of which the road to Milwaukee and the shore of New England had been in turn the scene? I would have given much to solve the twin mysteries, but how was it possible to follow the track of this automobile or this boat? Seated in my easy chair after breakfast, with my pipe lighted, I opened my newspaper. To what should I turn? Politics interested me but little, with its eternal strife between the Republicans and the Democrats. Neither did I care for the news of society, nor for the sporting page. You will not be surprised, then, that my first idea was to see if there was any news from North Carolina about the Great Eyrie. There was little hope of this, however, for Mr. Smith had promised to telegraph me at once if anything occurred. I felt quite sure that the Mayor Morganton was as eager for information and as watchful as could have been myself. The paper told me nothing new. It dropped idly from my hand, and I remained deep in thought. What most frequently recurred to me was the suggestion of Mr. Ward that perhaps the automobile and the boat which had attracted our attention were in reality one and the same. Very probably, at least, the two machines had been built by the same hand. And beyond doubt, these were similar engines, which generated this remarkable speed, more than doubling the previous records of earth and sea. "The same inventor," repeated I. Evidently this hypothesis had strong grounds. The fact that the two machines had not yet appeared at the same time added weight to the idea. I murmured to myself, "After the mystery of Great Eyrie comes that of Milwaukee and Boston. Will this new problem be as difficult to solve as was the other?" I noted idly that this new affair had a general resemblance to the other, since both menaced the security of the general public. To be sure, only the inhabitants of the Blue Ridge region had been in danger from an eruption or possible earthquake at Great Eyrie, while now, on every road of the United States, or along every league of its coasts and harbors, every inhabitant was in danger from this vehicle or this boat, with its sudden appearance and insane speed. I found that, as was to be expected, the newspapers not only suggested, but enlarged upon the dangers of the case. Timid people everywhere were much alarmed. My old servant, naturally credulous and superstitious, was particularly upset. That same day after breakfast, as she was clearing away the things, she stopped before me, a water bottle in one hand, the serviette in the other, and asked anxiously, "Is there no news, sir?" "None," I answered, knowing well to what she referred. "The automobile has not come back?" "No." "Nor the boat?" "Nor the boat. There is no news, even in the best in foreign papers."
"But your secret police information?"
"We are no wiser."
"Then, sir, if you please, of what use are the police?" "It is a question which has fazed me more than once."
"Now you see what will happen," continued the old housekeeper complainingly. "Some fine morning he will come without warning, this terrible chauffeur, and rush down our street here and kill us all."
"Good. When that happens, there will be some chance of catching him."
"He will never be arrested, sir."
"Why not?"
"Because he's the devil himself, and you can't arrest the devil."
Decidedly, thought I, the devil has many uses, and if he did not exist, we would have to invent him, to give people some way of explaining the inexplicable. It was he who lit the flames of the Great Eyrie. It was he who smashed the record in the Wisconsin race. It is he who is scurrying along the shores of Connecticut and Massachusetts. But putting to one side this evil spirit who was so necessary for the convenience of the ignorant, there was no doubt that we were facing a most bewildering problem. Had both of these machines disappeared forever? They had passed like a meteor, like a star shooting through space, and in 100 years the adventure would become a legend, much to the taste of the gossips of the next century. For several days the newspapers of America, and even those of Europe, continued to discuss these events. Editorials crowded upon editorials. Rumors were added to rumors. Storytellers of every kind crowded to the front. The public of two continents was interested. In some parts of Europe there was even jealousy that America should have been chosen as the field of such an experience. If these marvelous inventors were American, then their country, their army and navy, would have a great advantage over others. The United States might acquire an incontestable superiority. Under the date of the 10th of June, A New York paper published a carefully studied article on this phase of the subject. Pairing the speed of the swiftest known vessels with the smallest minimum of speed which could possibly be assigned to the new boat, the article demonstrated that if the United States secured this secret, Europe would be but 3 days away from her, while she would still be 5 days from Europe. If our own police had searched diligently to discover the mystery of the Great Eyrie, the Secret Service of every country in the world was now interested in these new problems. Mr. Ward referred to the matter each time I saw him. Our chat would begin by his rallying me about my ill success in Carolina, and I would respond by reminding him that success there was only a question of expense. "Never mind, my good Strock," said he. "There will come a chance for our clever inspector to regain his laurels. Take now this affair of the automobile and the boat. If you could clear that up in advance of all the detectives of the world, what an honor it would be to our department, what glory for you!" "It certainly would, Mr. Ward, and if you put the matter in my charge—" "Who knows, Strock? Let us wait a while. Let us wait." Matters stood thus when, on the morning of June 15th, my old servant brought me a letter from the letter carrier, a registered letter for which I had to sign. I looked at the address. I did not know the handwriting. The postmark, dating from 2 days before, was stamped at the post office of Morganton. Morganton! Here at last was, no doubt, news from Mr. Elias Smith. "Yes," exclaimed I, speaking to my old servant, for lack of another, "it must be from Mr. Smith at last. I know no one else in Morganton, and if he writes, he has news." "Morganton," said the old woman, "isn't that the place where the demons set fire to their mountain?" "Exactly." "Oh, sir, I hope you don't mean to go back there, because you will end up being burned up in that furnace of the Great Eyrie, and I wouldn't want you buried that way, sir. Cheer up, and let us see if it is not better news than that." The envelope was sealed with red sealing wax and stamped with a sort of coat of arms, surmounted with three stars. The paper was thick and very strong. I broke the envelope and drew out a letter. It was a single sheet, folded in four, and written on one side only. My first glance was for the signature. There was no signature. Nothing but three initials at the end of the last line. "The letter is not from the mayor of Morganton," said I. "Then from who?" asked the old servant, doubly curious in her quality as a woman and as an old gossip. Looking again at the three initials of the signature, I said, "I know no one for whom these letters would stand, neither at Morganton nor elsewhere." The handwriting was bold, both upstrokes and downstrokes very sharp, about 20 lines in all. Here was a letter, of which I, with good reason, retained an exact copy. It was dated, to my extreme stupefaction, from that mysterious Great Eyrie. "Great Eyrie, Blue Ridge Mountains, to Mr. Strock, North Carolina, June 13th. Chief Inspector of Police, 34 Long Street, Washington, D.C. Sir, you were charged with the mission of penetrating the Great Eyrie. You came on April the 28th, accompanied by the mayor of Morganton and two guides. You mounted to the foot of the wall, and you encircled it, finding it too high and steep to climb. You sought a breach, and you found none. Know this: none enter the Great Eyrie, or if one enters, he never returns. Do not try again, for the second attempt will not result as did the first, but will have grave consequences for you. Heed this warning, or evil fortune will come to you. M.O.W. Thus concludes chapters 5 and 6 of The Master of the World by Jules Verne. Again, if you've missed the other chapters of the novel, you can pick them up at the blog, which is publicdomainpodcast.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.